It is February the 23rd. This is the education sub of Ways and Means, and we are here this morning to hear from the Department of Education. We have all of the great leaders of the Department of Education here. Nancy Golden, Rob Saxon, and Ben Cannon are all with us, and we appreciate them. And who's going to go first? Nancy Golden.
Mr. Chair, if I can set this discussion up real quick.
Mr. Wilson.
The good news is you're finally starting education. But the bad news is from now on you get me as your analyst. So it's going from the nice young analyst to the grouchy old guy. So that's the bad news. I asked the education community or executive branch leadership, whatever you want to term them, to come in and spend 2 or 3 days talking about the education system overall. Will give the opportunity to sort of start wide and before you zero in on the various components. They'll also talk about the governor's budget in some as it relates to various parts of the system. There'll be plenty of more time to come back and talk about initiatives in phase two after we get through all the departments. What you'll see is a difference in approach between what the governor's recommended budget has in it and what the co-chair's framework is. The major difference is one where the governor's budget looks more at investments in specific areas, while the governor's or the co-chair's framework has about $325 million more in the state school fund and much less in specific new or expanded initiatives. So there'll be a real contrast in the approach as you walk through the next few weeks into the months on education. So I just wanted to set the stage a bit.
And part of that was kind of because the presiding officers, especially Senate President Courtney, kind of didn't give Devlin much choice. He said, you will have a co-chair's budget by the middle of January. And so because of the pressure of time, partly, they kind of did the 30,000-foot view and put money in the co-chair's budget in kind of large blocks, and which will leave it up to the Ways and Means process, including this subcommittee, to determine some of the specifics. But one of the things I want to hear from Nancy and others is in comparing the co-chair's budget to the governor's original budget, and especially dwelling on where there are significant differences, and there are significant differences, and why the one is preferable over the other, or where the compromises might be available. That's what we asked them to do, and we've given them most of this week to present to us. So, Nancy, welcome.
Thank you. Co-Chair Monroe and Co-Chair Kamp, for the record, I'm Nancy Golden. I'm the Chief Education Officer. And I'm just really pleased to be here today to talk about how we can accelerate students' learning so all of them will reach the 40-40-20 goal. I'm going to begin by giving an overview of what we refer to as the seamless system of education now that we're coordinating from birth through college and career. And then my colleagues will each come up one at a time because we have a small table and really talk about the particular areas that they lead and are responsible for. In addition to the people Senator Monroe said would be presenting, I wanted to add that we will also have the acting early learning director, that's Megan Irwin, and Iris Bell, the Youth Development Director. So you're having a whole team today. I want to start by telling a story, and this is a story of when I was superintendent, we had a No Excuses University. That's an elementary school for young children so they can start developing a college-going culture. And I was in the hall, and I saw a little guy. And I think if you've been an elementary principal or a superintendent, if they don't have that key around their neck that says they're going to the bathroom. You kind of lean down to make sure the little guy, who I think was a kindergartner, is going where they're supposed to go. So I leaned down, introduced myself, and said, "Where are you going?" And he said, "I'm going to college." So he's going, and really, the OEIB and the structure it represents, along with the other people, are going to get them there. So this is really through the lens of the child. How do we create a seamless pathway from birth through college and career to get every child where they want to go, whether it's graduating from high school into the world of work, whether it's going into a two-year college, getting a license, certificate, or transfer degree, or whether it's going into a four-year college. So our job in the OEIB is really to identify, measure, and replicate strategies that really work. I want you to know another major role is convening, and I'm going to give you an example. So we know how important third grade reading is, and we know the OEIB focuses on transitions. So we really start thinking of age 3 to grade 3, and how do we make that seamless for a child? So we brought together people throughout the state who have been really successful in the age 3 to grade 3 space. I think what was really unique about this convening is we made sure the faces of the people at the convening reflected the faces of our children. So it was a much more diverse table than we typically see. Not only did they represent the faces of our children, they all represented organizations that have been able to make a real difference in terms of making sure we reach that third grade reading outcome, because we know how important it is. So once we were together, we heard from the field, from their expertise. We brought the education policy people from OEIB to start doing the research so we could take the field knowledge and the research, and together we could start coming up with a recommendation. And that recommendation is one of the strategic investments that you're probably all aware of. Really, how are we going to make sure by the time we hit third grade reading, absolutely every single child is at that standard, because it gets a whole lot easier if you have that skill. So what we want to make sure is we deliver improved opportunities, and we do that by really making those transitions and the coordination smooth, and we want to remove barriers. And I would have to say removing barriers is my favorite part of the job. And sometimes, like in the early learning, we remove barriers by providing students opportunities by getting preschool or early learning that they wouldn't have if we weren't the seamless system. So I think we all know the 40-40-20 goal. If we don't, I certainly have done something wrong, but really that is our North Star. And if we think about this little guy and we think about all the other programs that are starting very early to make sure students have a college-going culture, you've probably heard of the Dreamer Schools, you've probably heard of College Possible, No Excuses. You know, it's really great to have kids start thinking of college and elementary school, but I believe if we set up that expectation, if we encourage the dream, we have to make it happen for all of our students. And so that's the business that we're doing. So I want to talk a little bit about how do we really go about this. First of all, the OEIB does, before the OEIB, there wasn't a statewide structure that really coordinated across the systems to make sure we reach outcomes for all kids. There were persistent barriers to student learning. I think the example we all know is, well, we all are aware that some kids come from homes that have hundreds of books and are read to every night, maybe 2 or 3 books every night. Other students are in homes where there isn't any books because they can't afford a book. So if you can think about the pre-literacy skills that one set of students are learning and the other set isn't, what we do know is there are some barriers we need to overcome for the students. You've probably all seen the data. To me, it's pretty profound that some students by age 3 hear 30 million less words than other students. We know words produce vocabulary. Vocabulary is one of the key skills for reading. So truly there are barriers for students that we do need to overcome. The other barriers are what we create as organizations. So we might have early learning, and then we have K-12, but have we really created the seamlessness? And again, I'll use an example from when I was superintendent in Springfield. It's a little bit embarrassing, but it tells the point. Until I really got involved in the OEIB and the Seamless System, one day I sat in my office and said, I've never even visited Head Start in my school district. And I felt embarrassed by that. So I set up a meeting. I went to Head Start. And when I was at Head Start, I was greeted by a woman. I wasn't sure who she was, but I thought I was supposed to know, so I didn't ask. And then she took me in, and she showed me the standards that they had for 3- and 4- and 5-year-olds. And I was thinking, are the standards that clear in the kindergarten classes that I oversee? And then, in addition to that, she showed me the portfolios, the collection of evidence that little 3- and 4- and 5-year-olds had. Of course, they were adorable, but I thought, do the kindergartners in the school district I work in have the same collection of evidence? She then took me in and showed me how they just-in-time do coaching of the teachers. They don't have time. They don't have money for release, so they just go in. And she said there's teachers who trade off if they have a particular skill, and they go in and they coach their colleagues. And I thought, that wouldn't that be a terrific strategy for me to use in the school district? Well, I was getting pretty excited about this principal. I thought I would recruit her to the school district. And it was about 2 hours later that another person walked in. And when the other person walked in, I turned to who I thought was the principal and said, so what role do you play? And this person said, I'm a parent of a child in the program. And I was so taken back by how empowered parents are in Head Start or some of the early learning. And I thought about this parent coming into the K-12 system that typically didn't have that level of empowerment, and thinking whether this parent would then get a signal, or not a real signal, but that they weren't as appreciated. And it made me realize how important it is that we really understand what each other's do, because we can learn a lot from places on the continuum, and we can also make a seamless system for our students. So really, making sure there's no silos, making sure it's seamless, is a key part of what we do as an education investment board. So we lead and coordinate a seamless public system from birth through college and career, and then we develop statewide student learning outcomes. These outcomes are on the achievement compacts. And what they really focus on, besides the whole pathway, are the key transitions, because that's how we eliminate the silos along the pathway. And then what we do is, once we have these outcomes, we think of what are the strategies, those are the strategic investments that we can really invest in, that then go to the governor's budget and are in front of you, that we believe are really going to leverage kids along the pathway. What's really clear is that one outcome leverages the next. And I talk a lot about third grade reading. And first of all, if kids come to kindergarten ready to learn, bring it on. We can get them reading by third grade. But why we know third grade is so important is because what the research shows us is you're 4 times as likely to drop out of school after third grade if you're not reading proficiently. You know, we're looking for graduates, we're not looking for dropouts. That's why the seamless system is so important. Also, what the research says, between kindergarten and third grade, if you have an intervention for a child, you have 85 to 90% chance of that child becoming a proficient reader. After age 9, you have 75% of the kids will never become proficient readers. So I think about when I was superintendent, or all the districts I was in, how much money we put in remediation all the way up the pipeline. I'm looking at Betty because I know as a principal, You know, in our school district, when a child doesn't read on time, then you need reading specialists, you need extra materials, you need a lot of interventions, which are costly. But to me, the biggest harm is the harm on the child's self-concept when they're not reading proficiently. Because we know we learned to read, but after third grade, we read to learn. It becomes increasingly difficult, which leads to things like chronic absenteeism and other things like that. So clearly, the idea around the outcomes on the Achievement Compact is one will leverage the other, and it will get easier as we move along. And the cost, there'll be a great return on investment and even a greater impact on a strong child's self-concept. So I want to share with you a little bit of the structure that we have. This is the new structure that was created, and basically what you'll just see here is it is my job to oversee the whole organization, make sure we're breaking down barriers, we're bridging the gaps from early learning through K-12 to higher ed. We're really reframing our work as policy and improvement and investment in a strong, what we refer to as P20 system. We recognize that the OEIB needs to be a nimble strategy setting board. It's not a super board that is overburdened by micromanaging the entire system. It really looks big at the policies and has to be super, super nimble. The OEIB works to ensure alignment through the chief education officer and her team. So Ben and Rob and I, we all get along great. Sometimes I'm surprised because I'm always calling them and saying, now let's talk about this. It doesn't seem that it will be, it seems like we have to work on this to make sure it's seamless for students. So that's part of my job, always looking through the lens of the child about how do they move seamlessly. This is another chart. Again, this just shows my relationship from the governor to the Department of Ed and higher ed. So I want to talk a little bit more about the Achievement Compacts and what's on the Achievement Compact so everybody know what are the outcomes the students need to meet to move seamlessly. And I'm going to go from the point of view of that little guy again. And I want to say if we're ready for kindergarten, that little guy is going to say, I'm ready. If he's reading proficiently by third grade, he's going to say, I'm a reader, and now I can learn to read. In fifth and eighth grade, if he's proficient in math, he's going to say, Algebra 2, here I come. I'm not scared of you. And then in sixth and ninth grade, if we eliminate chronic absenteeism because he can read and he has strong math skills, he can say, I love school. I'm going to be 100% attender. Ninth grade, now that he's 100% attender, he has strong math, he can read. Ninth grade, he's going to be on track. That means he has six high school credits and 90% attendance. After that, he's looking forward to taking three college credits in high school, which is another outcome. And when he takes those three college credits, what he's going to say is, I've tasted it, I love it, I can do it, and I'm going. And then once he's going, we got to make sure college is affordable, which is an outcome. And he's going to say, I did 1 year of college and high school. I can afford it. I've got a scholarship, and I will graduate. And then a completion is the last outcome. And he'll say, I'm a college graduate. I have a job. I can buy a house. I can stimulate the economy, and we're all going to prosper. So those are really the outcomes on the Achievement Compact. Ready for kindergarten, reading at third grade, sixth and eighth grade math proficiency, sixth and ninth, no chronic absenteeism, ninth grade on track, three college credits, accessible college, and completion of college. And literally what we do as the Education Investment Board is that we really make sure kids, the systems align, and students can move seamlessly through that system. Reaching the outcomes are a joint responsibility of the OEIB and the education entities. So if people aren't hitting the targets, we have to ask at the state level, what investments do we need to make, what policies do we need to change, and what systems aren't in place to really make that happen. And, of course, at the local level, people have to ask the same thing, too. The achievement compacts are the heart of the work we do because they are the targets that we're trying to reach out for kids so they can move seamlessly through the system. I want to talk a little bit about scaling up. You all know that in the last session you allocated about $75 million to really look at some strategic investments, some what I call some investments in incubating really important ideas that we could scale up across the state. Our research and policy team, which is a very small team of five people, they actually study each of these scale-up projects. I want to give you an example of one of the of just one example. We could give you many. And the research for this example was done by our research team in addition to Education Northwest. This is the Eastern Promise. I think you've all heard of that. We've had other scale-ups, five scale-ups in addition to that. This is a group that has worked across K-12, community college, and university to ensure students can get college credit in high school. In 2013-14, there were 30,000 credits awarded to students in high school for students in the region. In addition to that, what the study starts showing is if you do credit by proficiency, which is the way they measure if students really have met the course requirements, that what you will see is that 80% of the students who had courses in high school will go to college as compared to 54% before. When we look at students in poverty, 72% will go versus 45%, which is what went before. The Eastern Promise has saved parents $1.7 million. And what we know is that the belief is that there'll be an additional 7% completing college because it's more affordable, because they were able to get those college credits in high school. So from the last session, we have examples throughout the state of strategic investments that have made a difference. I'd say one of the big differences between this budget and the last budget, strategic investments or budget, is this one is much more focused on scale up. How do we get what we knew work when we incubated across the whole state? So when you looked at our age 3 to grade 3, we're really talking about how do we ensure that every student in every school district can benefit from what we've learned. And I think you know what that strategy is. That strategy is really about making sure for any child not on track, they have summer school before kindergarten, first grade, second grade, and third grade, and after school with community-based organizations. The beauty of that is that once students are on track, when they get to the classroom, it's all about acceleration. It's not about a teacher having six or seven different groups needing to catch kids up, working with kids on track. It's all about acceleration. So when you lift up the kids who need it the most, you're lifting up all the students. So this is truly a strategy that impacts all of our students.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Kump.
Nancy, thanks for being here. I really appreciate it. Somewhere in the process, maybe it's a couple weeks from now, will you be giving us figures that are like this, the, you know, how much savings that those college credits were for parents, the 1.7, so that we have a really good foundation to make decisions as a budget committee?
Representative Comp, we'd be happy to do that. Okay.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along that same line, I have been reading some stuff on the Eastern Promise and how well the kids stay in school afterwards. And some of those results did not look as promising. And I would love to see what's going on there and if we've identified ways in which we help enculturate these kids who are new attenders to college so that they can stay in school, because it's not just getting them there, it's not as important as finishing. And I just want to see what we're looking at with respect to that.
Senator Roblin, I'd love to give you that information because I so often as a superintendent would shake a child's hand at graduation and a year later I'd go to college and they'd say, oh, well, I got a job and after the first semester. And, you know, I really began to realize my job's not done as a superintendent until they graduate. So that's really both really important pieces of data that we'll bring to you. Thank you for that.
I like the idea of encouraging children from early age that they're going to college.
Mm-hmm.
My wife started putting money away for my grandson's college the day he was born. And every year when she gets the form that says how much money is in there, now it's up over $25,000, she shows it to him. She says, see, you have $25,000 for your college education. You're going to college. She doesn't give him a choice. He's going to college. He's 10 years old now, and he'll go to college.
Exactly. There's a little bit of a downside to that. My grandson, I always talked to him about going to college, so I asked him when his basketball game was this weekend. He's 7. He said, Bubby, that's Yiddish for grandma. He said, I don't manage my sports schedule. I'm too busy getting ready for college. I thought, well,
I love it.
Be careful what we ask for. I just have a few more slides. I really do want to talk a little bit about how we can really leverage our communities. This making sure all students are career and college ready and meet the 40-40-20 could not happen without community engagement. I talked to you a little bit how we did that in Reading, but we're doing it all over. And I think you know the regional achievement collaboratives hold such great promise. And I've been across the state meeting with many of them. And there's such excitement about really incorporating not only the education entities, but the health and human resource, whatever it takes to make sure that our students do move seamlessly along the pathway. When I was in Lane County, I was part of what was called Connected Ed. It is one of the RACs. And when the president of the University of Oregon was as concerned about third grade reading as I was, I could see that we were really could get all the arrows going in the same direction. And when K-12 thought about how do we make sure students really get up on campus, really understand the value of campus, that was really significant too. And what we saw is that the amount of students going to college really increased from this 0 to 20 regional achievement collaborative. We've also done things like the statewide reading campaign that I know we received allocations for. We actually went into 5 communities, the communities most in need. We studied with the communities how could we do a campaign that you could engage with. We came up with this concept of story time, any day, anywhere. And what we realized is what families told us, first of all, some families said, I'm not a reading teacher, so how can I help my students read? But when you say it's just about talking to them, singing to them, playing with them, building vocabulary, everybody felt very empowered around that. So we really believe that's really going to help on our early end. What we also know is we have our early learning hubs, we have our STEM hubs, and we have so many structures on the ground to really support our students as they move along the pathway. I think the most beautiful thing about that is students really feel supported. They understand these structures, they see these structures. So we're really focused on that. And what we also know is that certain things have to happen for other things to happen. If you're not a good reader, we're going to have chronic absenteeism. We can't let that happen. So we have to have everything we can in line to make sure that does not happen. And then the last page, the almost last page that I'm going to talk about is just the equity lens. I think you all know we adopted an equity lens, and what that really means is that we do have a focus on our communities of color because we find that's where the majority of the children are in the opportunity gap, that we really need to come up with strategies to close the opportunity gap and also to address poverty. What we found is using collective impact makes a difference. If you've been to David Douglas, you will see how they do preschool. They're partnering with the Children's Institute, with housing. They're putting all those wraparound services to make sure children will be successful. We also have seen certain programs that make a difference with children that we haven't been able to do in our public schools. So they're really key partners, like SEI in Portland, who really has gotten tremendous results, and now they're using their strategies inside some of the public schools, a great partnership. We know about programs like NAYA, Native American Youth and Family Centers, that really honors the elders and their cultures. And when I went to visit NAYA, I couldn't believe how many of the elders were in the school, and they say every single day. It really was a community place where everybody could come together to wrap their arms around their children being successful. So part of the equity lens is really learning from the people who have made a difference with our students in the opportunity gap and making sure we partner with them in order to get them out of the opportunity gap.
Nancy, nutrition is a very important part of that as well. And I know Betty and I have been working for years to get various school nutrition programs beefed up and continuing through the summer, and not only lunch, but breakfast and so on, because we find as teachers that students that are not getting proper nutrition have a hard time learning.
Senator Monroe, I totally agree with you. I know a lot of the teachers in the systems I've been in, you know, you get very scared about letting your kids go for the summer. You're wondering where they're going to get food. In many districts, the district I was in, we started doing backpacks for the weekend because we heard from kids that if they didn't have food, they wouldn't eat. So that's another reason why the early learning hubs are so important to us and all these structures, you know, the integration of community-based organizations. Our job is much bigger than just teaching skills. Our job is making sure kids have the basic needs they need in order so they can learn. And certainly food is one we just have to make sure that happens. So
remember last year I carried on one single day in the Senate, I carried two school nutrition programs, and I had one of my colleagues that said, well, when I was growing up, kids got fed at home. Uh-huh. Isn't that nice?
Right. And it's, you know, these are children. And, you know, that's one of the things I love being in education is just to make sure children's basic needs are taken care of. If it's not going to happen anyplace else, it's also why I believe teaching is the hardest work in the world, because not only do you have to teach the very high standards, make sure kids move seamlessly, catch them up, but you also have to take care of the things we traditionally did not take care of. Yeah. So it is different times. So the other thing that's really important is that we have standards that connect across the system. Again, in the age three to grade three, what you're going to see as part of the investment is really working with all of the daycare that happens at age three and knowing and creating joint standards between age three and grade three. And this is just an example. But we have to make sure there's standards. And then we have to make sure we have a system that tests for the standards. Another example I think of great convening is, I know, you know, we're moving to smarter balance and that's good, but there's also a concern about over-testing throughout the state. And you can see how this happens. The federal government says you're going to do smarter balance, and then maybe the superintendent adds another test on, and then by the time you get to the building, the principal wants you to do another formative assessment. So we're really working hard to get the balance between what is an effective system that gives us the information we need about how do we know how kids are doing right away, how do we know how they're doing after a month, and what's the big picture at the end of the year that will help us change our systems. But we also want to make sure there's not over-testing. So that work's been a really nice convening, but we need to make sure there's a balance. And then the longitudinal database, which you've heard about, we've got to make sure we have a longitudinal database so we can measure our success and we can determine future investments and we can respond to the questions like you asked, exactly how much are we saving on college and questions like that. This is my last slide for sure, for real. Anyways, the other important things, and again, legislation that you put in place, is really to make sure we have quality teaching, that we're supporting our teachers. We all know what happens to new teachers. We've talked about how hard the work is. We know mentorship is important. We know the support they get in the first 5 years is going to determine whether they stay or whether they leave and whether they're really highly effective with our students. There's no greater indicator of what can make a child successful than a quality teacher. We want a quality teacher with absolutely every one of our students, and that's why the quality network is so important. And I know I'm preaching to a choir because you're all the people who said we need to make sure we have this. The other thing that's really important we've been working on is to make sure we have a diverse workforce that reflects the faces of our children. And again, there's some pilots out there who have started as early as middle school, getting students ready for a career in teaching. Some of these pilots have done things like gone to students who have graduated from biology, social studies, with degrees but didn't have jobs, and met with them and said, have you ever thought about a teaching career? Why don't you come into our districts and look at it? And people who never thought they wanted to be teachers got very excited about it and could go quickly back and get a get the teaching certificate. So we're doing a lot of work in that area too. So hopefully I've given you an idea of what we're doing to make sure there is a seamless system for every child, and that little guy gets to college. So with that, we're going to have Megan come up, and she's going to share the first part of our system, the early learning system.
Yeah, Senator Rowe, you have a couple of questions.
And Megan, welcome. Okay. Senator Roblin.
And I think there's a couple others. Nancy, the thing I haven't seen and I would love to see at some point, when we see the chart, it's always hierarchical. And
yeah.
So you've got the governor and superintendent of public instruction, and then down at the bottom is the school boards and so on. And I would love to see that flipped at some point, so that the student is at the top of the page, and at the bottom of the page would be the governor and the OEIB, so that we recognize that here's where we're going. And if we don't, if those other people don't really inform us about what they need to the bottom of the end, it's hard to get anything in a... We are not a tightly coupled organization. And so if the people and that student don't buy into the system, it doesn't ever work. And so having conversations both ways in the system, make people believe it's not a top-down, it's more of an inclusive one. And we never see that. We only see the hierarchical top to bottom.
Senator Roblin, I'd love to create a chart like that. So I'm committing to you that I'll do that I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Yes, Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you. Thank you for that presentation. It's always, I learn something new every time I hear from you. Two things I wanted to, I think, reinforce what both Representative Comp and Senator Roblin said about feedback on those $75 million, specifically from the last biennium of, and I'm a great believer, and I understand that a lot of stuff you don't get overnight results. And at the same time, it would be useful for us going forward to say, here are the strategic initiatives we invested in, and here's how the results are coming so far. I think that would be very helpful. And then second, I wanted to go back to the flow chart, to the structure chart. Can you, and this is something can you explain a little better to me the role of the State Board of Education, because it kind of divides under the OEIB to the State Board of Education and the HEC. And I'm much more familiar with the HEC than I am with the State Board of Education. Just structurally, who is on it and their primary role.
Rob, do you want to come up? I mean, in terms of, I can give the overview, and then Rob can tell you specifically who's on it.
Okay.
You know, I would say that the OEIB does more of making sure there's a seamless system, and then when you get to Oregon Department of Ed, it's much more looking at things like making, they're the ones who will administer the Smarter Balance, they're the ones, their board is the one who worked with the U.S. Department to think about cutoff scores. They're also the ones who approve charter schools. So it's much more, they're the ones who make sure the standards are appropriate. And I think Rob's going to talk much more about that. So
okay.
My role is very much on the policy, focusing on those transitions and working side by side to break down the barriers that that make it so that make it so students will move seamlessly. So.
I'm happy to wait until your presentation if you can just make sure to cover that.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just for FYI, there is a great article in Saturday's Washington Post about teacher preparation programs and the support that our teachers need right from the beginning to be successful. And it's an easy read, and I would encourage you to take a look at it, because this is a topic that the federal government is looking at. They did last year, and we'll be doing some more research on it this year.
Thank you.
Good. Okay, we ready for Megan?
I'm ready.
Welcome. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Nancy. And thank you, Co-Chairs Comp and Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Megan Irwin, and I'm the Acting Early Learning System Director at the Department of Education. Tomorrow, we're going to go into a lot more specifics around the proposed early learning budget strategies, what we call our pathway to kindergarten readiness and third grade reading, or sometimes we also call it age 3 to grade 3. So today, what I'm going to do is simply orient you as a committee to some of the structural changes and improvements that we've made in early learning over the course of the last biennium. And I think that's actually important because it helps put the proposed budget strategies into some really interesting context. So as I think most members of this committee know, the work to reshape and to better organize the state's early learning system began as a policy conversation in 2011. During that legislative session and played out over the course of several legislative sessions. And the Early Learning Division, the entity that I'm charged to oversee, has only existed since July 2013, which is when the implementation of the early learning reforms really started in our state. And back when we got started on this path, this is what our early learning system looked like. The focus was programmatic. It was quite siloed. Early learning services were overseen by 5 state-level boards or commissions. They were administered by 5 state agencies and then delivered locally through 36 county commissions on children and families. And while I really firmly believe that each person that worked within this historical system had really good intentions for children and their families, I also think that the lack of coordination had consequences. And you can see that in our third grade reading outcomes. You can see that in our kindergarten readiness scores. You can see that in our rate of foster care placement and in our child health outcomes. So there were certainly consequences for the lack of coordination. Each part of this system had different goals, despite serving the same clients. And further, when we only focus on programs in the absence of creating a system, which is what this did, we only serve the people who find their way to us and who we have a slot for when they find their way to us. And this approach leaves a lot of families and children behind at a moment of life that I imagine is one of the most stressful moments of life if you're a parent. I have yet to get to experience that. And that is certainly the most critical time of life for developing brains of young children. So not the best way to approach early learning in a systemic way. Thanks to a series of important pieces of legislation that were passed by this body that I know members of this committee had a really big part in 2011, 2012, and 2013, the picture for our system looks pretty different today. From a governance perspective, we consolidated 4 of the commissions and councils I mentioned previously into 1 early learning council, which is charged with coordinating the administration and policy for all programs for children younger than school age in the state. And from an agency perspective, we consolidated functions and programs from 3 agencies into 1 division. So we moved the early childhood programs from the former Commission on Children and Families over. We moved the Office of Child Care from the Employment Department to the Early Learning Division, probably the most significant structural change that we made that really acknowledges child care as a critical early learning setting and an important work support for families. So we're now thinking of child care as both in this state. We moved Early Head Start and the Oregon Pre-Kindergarten Program over into the division. And so today, all of the state's core early childhood programs, with the exception of, I think, 3 home visiting programs that are administered by public health, are administered within the Department of Education. That's a really big deal. Simultaneous to this work, the health authority created a child well-being team that's run out of the OHA director's office, and the state's child health director serves as a member of the leadership team at the early learning division to make sure that we're really tightly coordinating between health and early learning, which is important because one of two places that children show up most frequently before they enter school is the doctor's office. The other place is child care. And finally, we moved 36 county commissions on children and families into a network of 16 early learning hubs that function as our local service coordination partners. That's a subject that I'll go into more detail on tomorrow, and I imagine I'll continue to go into lots more detail on the hubs as we move through the session and have conversation about that. There we go. Thanks. So the restructuring that I just described was critical in order for the early learning system to actually deliver on its mission, which is to support all of Oregon's young children and families to learn and thrive. Statutorily, we're charged with ensuring that children arrive at kindergarten prepared for formal schooling, and we take that responsibility really seriously and have worked to build an early learning division that's equipped to truly meet families and children where they're at from the time that they're born until they start school. And from that charge, we and our governing body, the Early Learning Council, were also given three high-level goals that we're responsible for in our work, and these goals are also in statute as requirements for the work that we're doing. So we are responsible for making sure that we have an early learning system that's coordinated, aligned, and family-centered, that children are raised in healthy, stable, and attached families, that children have supports that they need to be ready for kindergarten when they start school. And all of our work flows back to these three goals, and as we walk through the age 3 to grade 3 pathway tomorrow, you'll see how each of our recommended strategies, potential things that you could choose to invest in, point toward at least one of these three goals, and some of them point toward all three. As my final slide for today, I just wanted to draw your attention to what can happen when we take a systems approach to reaching these goals. By weaving together the really excellent work that our early learning service providers and programs do with families, the parts that we have sort of disparate right now are able to form a more effective and leaner whole. When we take a systems approach and we're able to work across health, human services, K-12, education, early childhood programs, and the private sector, which in our world, in the early learning world, that private sector includes just over 4,000 small business owners who we license to provide childcare to more than 130,000 children under 5. When we do that, we're able to do the things listed on this slide. We're able to identify the population of children who are most at risk, children whose home life isn't stable, whose health needs may be going unmet, and who may be at risk of arriving at kindergarten unprepared. And then we can work with caregivers and families to understand and evaluate the needs of these children, work across sectors to connect them to services that will most meet those needs. Some of the services that we're connecting folks to have existed for a long time. Others we're actually just developing now through community-based innovations that the legislature funded in the last session. And finally, we can then account for outcomes collectively, making school readiness a goal not just for early learning providers, but for our healthcare system, and for our human services system, and for our K-12 system. And we're starting to see that really begin to happen. So that's all for today, just a quick overview. We'll pick up this thread tomorrow, and I'm looking forward to discussing the age 3 to grade 3 pathway with you. So I'll take any questions on this before I hand it off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Megan, first of all, thank you for coming out to the Dalles and doing the early learning visits with me. Wonderful morning and very informative. Thanks. And if you're going to cover this tomorrow, that's great. I just want to throw this out there and ask, is there going to be and if there already is, inform me of that too, but a more formalized effort to coordinate learning with daycare and preschool type providers, if they're receiving state monies through ERD, employee related daycare or something like that, where there are going to be some requirements to teach ABCs, 1-2-3s, whatever that might look like, so that we are incorporating that effort for kindergarten preparedness.
Yes, co-chairs Comp and Monroe, Representative Huffman. Thank you. That's such a good question. I also really enjoyed that morning out in the Dalles. That was a great visit. But to your question, yes, there are a couple of efforts underway to make sure that child care providers are getting the professional development and support that they need to be able to have formal learning environments happening, whether it's a family care home or a center. Right now, it's optional. We're going as far as we can within our regulatory authority, and then taking a further step to actually build an early learning environment is optional, but we're building incentives in. So one incentive, when we get into the child care subsidy conversation, is tiered reimbursement. So if you're at a higher level of quality and a parent selects your program, the copay goes down for that parent, and the reimbursement level is higher for the provider. So that's one incentive that we're using to connect to ERDC. And then through our quality rating improvement system work, we've been able to offer financial incentives to providers that want to improve the learning and development that's happening in their programs on purpose. The final way that we're making those connections is through the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation Grant that we had this biennium that's allowed child care providers to connect with the K-3 educators in their community to do shared professional development. And that's one promising practice that we're looking to scale through the age 3 to grade 3 literacy initiative.
Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This is for Doug. I don't remember if I was sleeping and dreaming this, but is not ERDC in Human Services, or is it with us?
Madam Chair, it is in, and Mr. Co-Chair, it is, the budget is part of the DHS, but the money, a large share of the money comes through Megan's office from the Child Care Development Grant. So there's a transfer of funds, but the program administration is tied in DHS.
Clarification, sir?
Mm-hmm.
So then, again, is the money posted in Human Services? And then the OEIB board applies for those funds?
No, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, trying to figure out the best way to say it. I mean, really the legislature decides how much will be spent on ERDC, both the general fund portion and the federal funds portion, sort of a joint decision.
Got it. Thank you very much.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Monroe. Doug?
Yes.
However, the ERDC, we're hearing it, Mr. Wilson, we're hearing that in front of Human Services. It's going through the Policy Committee of Human Services. So just so that, clarification.
And Co-Chairs Comp Monroe, members of the committee, I mention it only as just an important part of our child care system, but we can certainly stay away from the weeds of employment-related daycare in this committee, unless you really want to go down into them.
Mm-hmm. Senator Roblin.
Yeah, in Nancy's presentation at the beginning of the day, she talked about the story of the going into the Head Start program. And I have always wondered, we have a training system that is training parents at that level who could be really helpful in training people at preschools and other things that don't have that. So have we actually had a conversation about how some of those same people could be volunteer trainers of the kinds of things that are important? Because we know it's not necessarily about ABCs, it's about exposing them to a lot of different things in language and all of those other kinds of things that develop the brain along the way. And that's a lot of what they treat those parents, because the reality is the things that those parents are expected to do at home to help their kids are exactly the same things that we want taught at in those preschools and those early childhood fields. Have we had those kinds of conversations with a workforce that's already out there and a trained group of people?
Yes, Co-Chairs Comp and Monroe, Senator Roblin, I love that question, because not only is what Head Start does for its parents good to spread into child care and other early learning development programs, it is so empowering for those families. So in Oregon, we have something that's called the Oregon Registry Online, which is like the professional development hub for early learning. And Head Start parents who want to become trainers can become master trainers through that program. And we actually, through our federal child care funds, are able to financially support some of that. So that is already going on. The question then becomes, how do we connect the professional development work that's happening in early learning to the professional development work that happens on the K-3 side so that both are learning from each other in a meaningful way and we're spreading that really good social-emotional work that we do in early learning up into the K-3 system? Those are conversations that are playing out through the work that we're doing to build the Age 3 to Grade 3 Literacy Initiative. So there's strong professional development in early learning, strong professional development on K-12, on the K-12 side, and we're just beginning the work to weave it together.
Okay. Nancy, where are we?
So next we're going to bring Rob Saxton up, and the very first thing he'll do is answer Representative Smith Warner's question about the difference, what do they do in relationship to the Oregon Education Investment Board.
Welcome.
Good morning. Co-chairs Comp and Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rob Saxton, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, and it's great to be here this morning. I'm looking out at the schedule, and I think just the department's part of this is 15 hours starting on March 3rd, and then you're stuck with me a little bit today, so I'll try to be minorly entertaining because otherwise you're going to get sick of me. But it is a pleasure to be here, and thank you for your service on the committee. So my first slide, if I can make it go. There we go. Actually, Senator Roblin, this is a slide that might be a little bit like what you were asking for from Nancy, and it is a different looking slide about organization, and of course it doesn't have anything about the state board on there, so I'll have to fix that as well. But I could also bring you one that is really a hard structured kind of methodology, a lot like what you saw from Nancy. But when I got to the department and we began to do our work, it was really important for us to talk about what it is that we at the department do for kids and how it is that the work that we do impacts outcomes in student learning, and that it isn't just an agency that does work for the sake of being an agency, but that we want to make sure that the work that we do contributes to learning for students. And so when we started working on putting together a strategic plan for ourselves and thinking about the work that we had to do, we created this really odd sort of organizational structure chart because it helped us really think about what we wanted to be, which is keeping students really in the center of all the learning that, or everything that happens at the department. And so what you'll see is this office of learning that's at the center of this graph in the darker color, and within it three sub-offices, which are our instruction standards, assessment, and accountability unit, which is at the bottom. And that really is a department that works on supporting teachers to be effective at the work that they do, setting learning targets and supporting those targets, assessment, and then all the federal monitor and accountability, but technical support that comes along with that. So things like around Title I or ELL or Title VI, which is for our students of color, and the work that happens with that. And then our Office of Equity, which is also is led by Assistant Superintendent David Bautista, which is an exciting new department and works on closing the achievement gap and supporting students who are English language learners. And then our Student Services Unit that works on special education and early childhood intervention and early childhood special education. And then you'll see this little dot in there that says OSD. That's the Oregon School for the Deaf. And we like the fact that they're in the middle of our Office of Learning. It is the one school that we directly support and that is part of the Department of Education, and having them right in the middle of that Office of Learning is a really good place to have them, and that we can bring our full support to bear in the work that happens at that school as well as at many other schools. And then if you look around the outside, you'll see that we have the Office of the Deputy Superintendent, which hopefully provides some leadership. Finance and administration, which works on the state school fund and any kinds of financial services the department does, whether it's running contracts or making purchases. And then information technology, which is all things computer and technology, as well as all the data systems that we use to collect information about student outcomes and student information so that we can make good long-term decisions. And then lastly, research and data analysis, which is led by Brian Reeder and is a very small department. And it really is that all of those support functions come around our central service which is in the Office of Learning and makes a difference about what students experience when they're in school and also hopefully supports their learning. So more directly to the question about the State Board of Education, the State Board of Education really is made up of community and education stakeholders. They're appointed by the governor. It's a 7-member board. And just to give you a sense of who is on the board and what their life experience is like, as opposed to naming people, we have two board members who are college professors. We have one that's an ex-superintendent, one that is CEO of a Spanish media company, one that is a lawyer, and one that is an education leader for one of our tribes. And I believe that all of them either are or have been parents who had children in the Oregon K-12 system. I might be off on one of those, or might be one of our college professors that didn't, but they all have, and they've all had some of that kind of experience. And the work that they do really is about setting the Oregon administrative rules around education. And so anytime that, for example, legislation is passed, and then there's more detail that would need to be lent to that, that would set up with how that's exactly going to work within school districts, they would go to work on setting up those rules so that we knew specifically around the policies and procedures and the rules and expectations that would come out of that. So just a couple more specific examples. They adopt all the standards that we intend to have students learn in the state of Oregon, and there are multiple standards in multiple subjects. So in health education, for example, or social studies, science, English language arts, math. So that there are 8 different areas where they adopt standards. And then also they would set policy and create rule. So some of the policy might be how many hours of instruction should students be delivered in each grade level across the state, or how many credits does a student need to earn and what do they need to be able to demonstrate that they can do to earn an Oregon diploma. So those kinds of things. And if there's more detail, I can certainly get it and bring it back to a future presentation.
So the difference between us, we're not a rulemaking organization. We're really just focused on that pathway and the key transitions and what strategic investments to meet the outcome. They also end up being the organization that does the investigations. A lot of times investigations move up from school districts to the State Department and hear other complaints, and all the charter schools go through you too.
Correct.
Senator Roblin.
Yeah, and you could tell them there's not that many. The sections in the OARs and the sections in the ORSs that are directly educationally resolved are the ones that you are, that board is responsible for, correct?
Co-chairs Compton Monroe, Senator Roblin, yes, that's true.
And it's the Division 22 standard. Education, what are the OARs that we have been designed through the board?
Right. We call them the Division 22 standards, and so they're in Division 22 in the
OARs.
Right. Okay. Our agency's mission statement, and this is a mission statement that we worked on in the fall of 2012 as we worked to sort of reinvent the department, if you will, is that the Oregon Department of Education fosters excellence for every learner through innovation, collaboration, leadership, and service to our education partners. And again, the part that I like about this is that it fosters excellence for every learner, that we keep keeping learners at the center of the work that we do. And then lastly, I just wanted to show you today, this is my last slide, I'd be happy to answer questions, of course, that our strategic plan that we adopted late in the fall of 2012, early 2013, is our strategic plan, and it has 5 different goals on it. And those goals are about learners, making sure that they graduate from high school and they're ready for college, career, and civic life, a goal around educators, because we want to make sure that educators in the state of Oregon are absolutely the best that they possibly can be, and that we're supporting that. The schools and districts are highly effective, and we do a lot of work around supporting schools and districts. That we engage communities as we do this work, and that we're representative of the communities that we serve, and that we create partnerships in order to do it, because there are all kinds of opportunities for us in creating partnerships that bring additional resource, support, and good thinking to the work that we have underway. And then lastly, that as an organization, the department needs to be really high functioning. We've got to be smart about how we do our business and the way that we go about doing our work. We need to attract great employees and support them to improve in what they do. And that when we're really good, it makes the work much, much easier, and we can actually accomplish what's in our strategic plan and make our mission a reality. So I'd be happy to answer questions, but those are the three slides I have, just very high overview stuff to present today to start off. Are there any questions?
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Saxton. I really appreciate what you have brought forward, and your leadership has been, well, I'm not your supervisor, but it's been exemplary. But are you going to be able to, well, I know you're able, when will you be presenting to us and working with Mr. Wilson about your budget from 2013 to our projected budget? Because I like to read that line by line because I'm so bored with life. But
Co-Chair Comp, I apologize that that would be your evening's entertainment, but we begin that, I believe, on March 3rd.
Okay.
And we're slated for about 10 days of presentation. And when you look at the department now, we've moved from a department that really was K-12 to including early learning and then the youth development division. And then the partnership that is created really by the convening that OEIB does that helps us with the transition between early learning and K-12. And then my partner, Ben Cannon, who is with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, has really expanded the way that we think about what we do and the importance of making sure that we're providing high-quality experiences for children from the time that they're born until the time that they exit our school system in graduate school, has really changed how we look, how we think about what we do, and what our budget looks like significantly as well. Even just the bringing of the early learning division into the department, you know, increased the number of people who work at the department by over 100. And so since from 2013 forward, we really are a different agency than what we used to be. And it actually is quasi-exciting to look at our budget. I look forward to presenting it.
Just one other brief question. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I used to ask this question to teachers, but what's been your most exciting thing that you've done this year?
Co-Chair Comp, thank you for the question. There are so many different ones, but honestly, the most...
And your boss is sitting next to you.
I see that. Yeah. The most excitement that I have right now and what really is driving me more than any other thing is the opportunity to work on the age 3 to grade 3 literacy initiative. I just look at, I think about 33 years as an educator in Oregon and really trying to figure out what is it that we're going to do that is substantially going to make a difference for kids. I mean, every educator has this dream, right, that they're going to show up where they teach or where they administer or whatever it is, and on that day they're going to do something that's going to change the life of a person who they serve. It's going to really change the life of a child. And when I look at us in the information age, at a time when if you can't access information, if you can't read, I just don't know how you survive. And we have a 68% reading achievement level in the state of Oregon right now, and it's not what it needs to be. And we can do things that change that if we can just put together a system that's smart and that's comprehensive and is implemented really well. And I think we've designed something up that does that. And it's going to, you'll know that when I come in front of you starting in March, that there's a really big ask that's associated with that. But of all the asks, of all the things that I've ever thought about in my career, it's the thing that really has me excited, because I know that as we begin to move from 68% of our students being readers to upwards of 90% of our students being readers, it will change who we are as a state.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it will change the lives of those kids. They'll be able to read. They'll be able to access content. I can read about what it is that I need to know, and I can learn it. And I've never been able to do that before, or I wouldn't, but for the fact that this initiative is put in place and is actually done well. And now I have a chance to be a productive member of society. I can provide for my family, and it changes what we look like financially as a state and who we become. I mean, it is the thing. And when we're able to deliver on that and actually see it happen, I just can't imagine what it means for that individual and for us as a state in a collective way. And so I'm really excited about that. There are a bunch of other things, too. This job has afforded me so many really wonderful opportunities to think about that and try to deliver on what it is we're hoping to accomplish, that it's truly been a joy. So I appreciate the question, but that is the thing.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin.
And I also want to comment. I think you are doing and have done an amazing job since taking over your position. I look at your strategic plan and long-term goals, and the one that I hope at some point we can start thinking about again in a different way. When I came here a long time ago as a math teacher, ODE was known for an exceptional group of subject matter expertise. And anybody in any little school district who said, oh, I need to know more about my math standards, there was a person at the department that everybody in Oregon said, that's the guy to go talk to. Because the agency over time has become more of a policing agency in a lot of ways, and holding accountability, we've lost what I thought was the most essential part of the department, and that is an expertise base that a teacher in Coos Bay, Oregon, or North Bend could call up and say, can you get me the material? Can I talk to someone who really understands whatever the latest is in math or whatever? I don't see that in the goals. I see making ODE the best place to work, but I would hope the department personally would get back to that, because I think it had the greatest opportunity to change the way districts did things, because they had the people that everybody saw as the experts. And I am sad to say that that's not the case.
Co-Chairs Compton Monroe, Senator Roblin, thank you for that. And I remember those days as well, right, as a high school math teacher and then as a principal, and some of the expertise. I will tell you that we do have some of those people at the department, and every one of them is completely top-notch. We just don't have very many.
Right.
And our second goal, educators, making sure that we support educators is really where that lives. And doing that support and making sure that we have good standards and so forth. I think that you would find that in the last 2 years, the department has changed significantly in that area, and that we do now have some real experts that are often out working with school districts and individual educators, and I'm constantly pleasantly surprised and pleased at the response that we get, and that we've intentionally, our equity department, for example, we have said, this is not about compliance. This is about support. We need to be able to go out and meet with school districts around ELL and Title III and say, here's what we see in your program. Here are some suggestions about how you might improve this program, and we'd like to come and help you do that, as opposed to, we see something wrong, and now there's a demerit against you, and here's how we're going to penalize you. And that even within our compliance monitoring that's required by the federal government, you'll see in our strategic plan next week that we have a goal that says, when we leave compliance monitoring, we're going to survey where we've been, and we want to know that it was that compliance monitoring, there's federal government compliance monitoring, the feds give us dollars to do, that it was a positive experience, that you were treated with dignity and respect, and that when we left, we offered you suggestions that will help you improve your program so that we get different outcomes with students, and that while we're meeting the letter of the law around compliance, this is really about support, not monitoring and compliance.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow we'll start with what, HEC?
Yes, we will do 11 through 14 and then the higher ed.
Okay, Mr. Wilson?
Well, I guess that means that today's done. wasn't sure if you were to do more today or not, Nancy. But
we did plan to work flexible, so if it's time to end now, we're fine with it.
A good place to break. I mean, we all have other.
Yes.
Yeah, things going on.
I appreciate that. So.
Okay.
Okay. Good
enough.
We'll start tomorrow. Thank
you
very much.
Yeah, we'll start with Mr. Cannon tomorrow, and we're adjourned.
Thank you very much.